down to your great-granddad's Peerless. Welcome to No Driving Gloves, the car talk authority, where experience, knowledge, and controversy share the same seat. Enjoy the ride. Now your hosts, John and Derek.
What up, what up?
It works for some famous guy, so I'm going to try it.
John, I just realized when this is the first time I've realized it when you were doing the played the intro there. I didn't realize we ever captured the startup of my 1919 Chevrolet there at the beginning, the 490. It sounds just like that.
Hey, it does, doesn't it? I learned that from Mr. Tony Watley. We refer to him occasionally because he uses a very similar car sound at the beginning, and that was him recording his Viper. But we wanted to be a little bit different. Jeez, everybody's got a Viper and has heard of Vipers.
Yeah. No, I just realized that. Thought, hey, I forgot that we recorded that. It's that Chevy sounds good, doesn't it?
Well, it's got a little to it.
So how are you doing this week, John?
It's gotten to me. Driving's gotten to me this week. Just a little too much driving this week, but good cigar time. Which hey, I learned I go. Need to consume some cigars because I had a new piece of furniture delivered this week and it wasn't big enough.
The cigar or the furniture?
The furniture.
Oh. Big enough for what?
I got my cabinet humidor this week.
Saw that post.
It's a commercial unit. It holds 1,200 cigars. And I still had to keep one of my old humidors because I had more than fit into this box.
That's called a problem, John. That's what that is called.
The value is hard to put on them, but I could have had a car or two. So what you up to? We got to get to a show here. Quit boring the listeners.
Well, I don't know. Seeing how the week was going. Hey, I don't have any problems in my life. I just had to build a 30 by 45 with 14 foot ceiling pole barn to store my problem. That's the same as you buying that big humidor, right?
And somebody pointed out when I put it on one of the cigar pages and I mentioned that it was full. It's something I always talked about when I was at barber's. Excuse me, my cough's still an allergy, so I haven't gone away. No matter how big a building you build, how big a humidor you buy, it's kind of arrogant. But if you've got the money for the humidor, if you got the money for the building, you got the money to fill it. Unless you're overextending yourself like some Americans. But if you like.
It's true. I'll agree with you. I'm not. I don't think John or I are rolling in the dough, but we have decent careers that have afforded us lifestyles that are nice and we can have some toys. So I'll agree with you there, John.
Well, like I said, even going back to the museum, well, hell, look at your boss too. They have these huge buildings. And it built the Barber Museum 180,000 square feet in 2002, 2004. And in 2013 or 14, they had to add another 120,000, 150,000 square feet because they had filled the first 180,000 square feet. So, and the Lane Museum's kind of packed the last time I had
visited. I think it's the term for it is overcapacity, John. We are full. We are full.
Fire marshal says you can have 150 cars in this building and you have 312.
312, that's what it is.
I don't know. I just randomly picking numbers from the sky.
We'll run with that number. There we go.
But why we're on this topic of filling our buildings and filling our humidors, we're actually going somewhere with this. Because it's how the topic of this show came up. I sent you a link earlier this week.
You sure did.
Here's a decent Beretta, $3,300, 1990 Chevrolet Beretta Indianapolis 500 pace car. And you've talked about maybe getting another Beretta at some time or such. And I believe your response to me was something to the extent of, well, I've got the quote right here. not a 93, not a black GT.
Yep, exactly.
Where's the topic? I'm thinking about that. And my dad has this rule that he won't own any diecast or anything of cars that he doesn't own the car of. Cord 8, 10, 8, 12 exception. But when we're trying to relive our youth, they're trying to relive the past. Is it absolutely necessary to have what we had? I saw this Beretta, good price, not going to kill the budget. It needs a touch of work, but it's one of the rarer editions. It's not the yellow, it's the teal. So very 1990s color. And you'd stand out in a crowd. But for your Beretta, do you absolutely have to have a 93 black GT if you're going to buy another Beretta? Or could you get a Z26 Beretta? Or could you get, I'm going to say you're going to settle for a four-cylinder Beretta or a four-door Beretta called the Corsica.
Corsica.
Or Corpsica. But it really got me thinking. And it got me thinking about me buying stuff from the past.
I think it's odd. You sent that, and I talk about it a lot. I've talked about it on the show, Beretta. And I think for me, for some reason, yes, it has to be a 1993 black Beretta GT with the teal and purplish pink decals. The GT was teal and this purplish pink color on the side, and the honeycomb snowflake style wheels that the Jeep Beretta had. They were black on the car I had. The only thing that I would say that I would probably accept being different with a 93 Beretta GT in black, my car, well, the gray, it would have to have gray interior too, because that just looks killer together. But my car was an automatic. And I think if I was to get another one, if I could find a stick shift manual, I would probably get the manual transmission version because they were just a little bit more fun in the end. There was a little more fun to be had in one of the stick shift Berettas than in the automatic. So I think visually all the appearances would have to be the same, but mechanically I could switch out for a stick shift.
Getting all kinds of messages here. Boom, 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 boom.
I was going to say, all our listeners there, just pop it in, be like, you guys rock. Berettas forever. There we go. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah, you can't pass up. When I talk about my CRX love. And when it comes to the second generations, the 88 to 91s, I don't care what color because I've owned them in various colors. And I've only owned SIs. And one thing about me is usually I've had the top model of whatever car I've owned. And so that's none of the, well, I got to have a slightly better. And the Beretta GT was kind of the top of the line when you had yours other than the Z26 trim level. But I could have that second generation in any other color. But when it comes to buying a first generation, unless it's a convertible, one of the 312 convertibles, which seem to be changing hands quite often this year, it has to be blue over gray 85. I don't want an 86 or an 87 SI. 84 didn't have an SI. It has to be that blue over gray because that's what I had back when I was 16, 17 years old. I want the same car. And I'm thinking of some of the other cars I've had in the past that maybe I'd like to re-own. I would like to have another Isuzu truck, but I had a black one and I had a white one. So I don't know. There is a black now, Isuzu truck for sale locally that it's got a 400 V8 swap in it, blah, blah, blah. That's a black. And it's tempting because it's even a decent price. I just don't like buying other people's projects.
Exactly. But so here's another question, John, because I thought about this when we were talking about this being the topic. Talk about you go back and you find, or you go out today and find that car. I'm scrolling through the internet now because, well, it came up and now we're talking about it. Just found one that is very, very similar to the car I had, except for the rims. It looks pretty similar. But how far do you go? Because the other car in my life that unfortunately left my ownership, and it's the only classic car my dad and I have ever sold of the collection we now have, was my 1974 Pontiac GTO. And I love that car dearly, but of course decisions had to be made at one point in life, and that car had to go. If I still want a 1974 Pontiac GTO at some point back in my life. But to me, the only way to go in getting a 1974 back into my collection is to find that specific car. In other words, I still have the VIN number to this day. I know the VIN number of the car. And if I'm going to get a GTO back, it has to be that one. So how far would you go, John, in getting it back? My understanding from my dad, who followed the car for a short time through some friends that he had that knew of where the car went, the person who bought it, I think, wound up stripping it down, painting it black, and doing some things to it, which really was heartbreaking because we restored the car to the exact factory specifications that it came out of Pontiac with. And so obviously I'd have to put it back to what it was: Buccaneer red, the white seats with the red piping, blah, 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 blah. But I think for me with that car, and the reason I would want to go back to that specific car, is just the nature of that being one of the cars Dad and I restored together. Our hands worked together on that car to build it into and bring it back to life. So how far would you go, John? Is there a car that you would go back and hunt down the specific exact one by VIN number, or is that not important to you?
I would always like to have the exact same car back, but I don't think there's a car I would absolutely have to have the exact same VIN number. Like my 78 Caterham, I know where it went. I could probably track it down. It's tempting to buy another Caterham right now. I would love to have that one back. I regret ever selling it. But the price would have to be right in comparison to the market. It still would have to be a good deal. And if I had to buy something else, I could buy something else. I think if it was a Series 3 Caterham like I had, I would want that one back. But if I had to go to a newer Caterham 160 or a real Lotus 7, get back into that style of car, it wouldn't kill me either way. Love to have my blue CRX back, but I think that car's long, long gone. There's nothing I guess the VIN number to me right now isn't important, but I don't know if I have a car that I'm that connected to you or connected to as you are with your Pontiac GTO, because you have memories with your dad working on it. And that's something you'll never have again. And if you found it, it's obviously not in the same condition that it was. Maybe it would be a project for you and your kids to...
Oh, dude, I haven't even thought about that. That hits hard.
To rebuild and put back together. And then it'd be multi-generational type thing. So I can see you having to absolutely have the exact same VIN number. But I can't think of a single car in my history or even my parents' history, because my dad, one of my dreams has always been to try to be able to buy my dad a red 1960 Volkswagen Beetle convertible like he had back in his teenage years, or a 70 Dodge Charger he had a part with in 77 when my brother was born. Those were cars that I know he was very passionate about, but I wouldn't go to the point of tracking down the VIN numbers. When we were talking about, or when I was thinking through this topic and things to talk about, I almost, and the man's too busy now because of his damn TV show he did. But Will was on season two of Ride of Your Life with Courtney Hansen. And the premise behind that show is to give people back a car that they were forced to part with because of certain things in life, whether it was to pay for a kid to go through college or because of an illness or a death or just life in general. And one thing that always bothered me about that show is they're not giving them back the same car. They're just finding a similar car and they're not even replicating what they had. Here's a similar car, but it's got, these are all the improvements that you would have done when you owned it and modifications. And these people, I don't know if it's TV or not, are always excited to get the, number one, they're getting a free car, I think. But is it just, as picky as I am, I don't think I would require to have the exact same car. I just, something like it. VIN number, color, and things like that. Like I said, there's a couple models that I would almost have to have the exact same thing and the same color scheme and such. But when it comes down to the matching numbers so I can hang that title next to this title or whatever, I don't think so.
And it's interesting, John, because now I'm thinking back over all of the cars that I've owned. And interestingly, the Beretta was just a fun car, right? That was the car most I drove to high school. It was supposed to be the GTO. I think we've talked about this on the show before. Figured out the GTO was a little too rare for a high school kid to drive to school every day. The way the one we had was one of 687 built the way it was, four speed hatchback, all the options that were on it. It was a pretty rare version of the 74 Pontiac GTO. So dad was like, yeah, I don't really think you should drive that to school. So it's interesting because that's when we got the Beretta. And the interesting thing is, of course, I've probably talked about it on the show as well. We bought the Beretta totaled. That car had a friends of my parents' son. It was his car, and he was driving it, and someone ran a stop sign and pretty much ripped the front end off of that car. It was pretty well obliterated when we got it. So, of course, got it cheap, right? Affordable for some high school kid to drive. And dad and I rebuilt that whole car. These are essentially, we have the Roosevelt, which I've worked on for years with dad and restoring it and all that. But I think when I look back on it, and now I'm just thinking about this, but the Beretta and the GTO are really probably two of the cars that I owned but that I really, I'm trying to think of the right word here. They're really the cars that I did a lot of the work on after learning so much growing up as a kid in the shop, working on other customer cars with dad, right? Working on various Corvettes that were in the shop for restoration, working on whatever cars were in the shop for restoration or at the Mitchell collection, working on cars there, wherever we were working on cars. I was always dad's helper, and I was always the gopher, right? Go for this wrench, go for that wrench, go get me this, go get me that. And on the Beretta and the GTO, dad and I were still working together on those, but they were mine. There was ownership in it, right? And there was that sense of this is me now becoming a grown up and I'm actually putting these cars back together and making them something for me to drive, for me to take out and show to the world the work I can do. So I guess I hadn't thought about that up until the point you were just talking. So it's interesting that the two cars I want back out of everything I've owned and gotten rid of, the Dodge Dakota pickup, the Dodge Durango, the some of the other pickup trucks I've had, things like that, that I would go back and want those two cars. And I'm putting it together. I think that might be it. I think it might be just that coming of age in restoration and mechanical and body work, that those were the two cars that find that moment in my life. So I think that's, and with the Beretta, I wouldn't need the exact one, right? For some reason, I don't feel like I need to go back and get the same VIN number Beretta that I had. One that looks like it and has most of the identical features, fine, great. But the GTO, there's something about the GTO that it's just, I really would have to have that VIN number back, I think. And when you said, I think what clicked it off was when you said, if we could get it back, it wouldn't be in the condition it was in when Dad and I did it. So you could look at it as a generational project where I now restore it with my kids and let that be an experience. That'd be a really great story. So now I'm going to start looking for the car.
I was going to say, that's the whole thing behind cars and, well, really any object, whether it be watches or cars or knitting kits, or is the story behind it what you remember. And that would be a great story with your GTO, and maybe that car is still out there. And for some reason, I feel this passion for have to have the exact same car that you VIN number. I don't know if that passion was really going to be there to me when it gets into things getting into the late 80s, 90s, aughts. And that seems like something that goes back to, what do I want to say, what is it, 16-digit VIN numbers? I think it's more important, or people attach that. I don't know any young person that says, I really want my 93 Beretta VIN number, XYZ, PDQ, whatever, excuse me, or I gotta have my Ford Focus RS. It just doesn't, I don't see that passion. I guess if you look at VinWiki or something, they track their exotics by VIN number,
I was just going to say that. I think that today in modern vehicles only exists in the exotic car world, where it's like, what VIN is it? Or what, basically, because those guys all know this is the 33rd car. This is the 33rd car built. That's what it will always be. So they can always track it. So I think you're right there, John.
And I wonder if there's so much disposable, because I'm thinking of an acquaintance of mine. I haven't seen him in years or talked to any of his family in years. But when he turned 16, he had specced out a Mustang GT that he wanted. And his parents ordered it for him. And when his father went to pick it up, there was a Shelby GT350 there. And the dealer talked to his dad about it, and his dad left the ordered Mustang GT and came home with the Shelby GT350 for his 16-year-old brand new driver. And that kid, his last I knew, still owned the car, and he's in his early 20s now. Surprisingly, he's still in his early 20s for a 16-year-old with a Shelby Mustang.
I was going to say, I thought that story was going somewhere else.
But no, I doubt if he ever lets that car go. It comes down to money and stuff that some of us can't. Jay Leno is very unique in that he's never sold a car, even from the days that he was penniless and sleeping in his cars. He's never sold a car. where some of us, to get the next car, we got to sell the last car, or we're just not as talented or patient as Jay is. I don't think there's much in my life that I would have to have the exact same thing.
So you're not a car guy then? That's what you're saying. No.
I'm a car person. I love car them people. All.
We're car people.
We ought to come up with our own acronym for something. Oh, like wow. That.
So I'm terrible at this. And so it's been over 10 minutes. So Devin, if you're still listening, we have to apologize. I didn't have the comment section turned on.
I saw the comment for Devin, and I wasn't sure how I was going to work my way to it. But
I'll just direct approach it, because I just realized I didn't have the comments on. Still getting used to getting back into the swing of these live streams. So I got to remember to turn the comment section on.
Well, let's just show that up there on the screen. How much more value with all original parts versus one that doesn't? So he's asking, in an all original car, I guess numbers matching, etc., how much more value would you put on that car than a standard automobile?
I'm wondering, because we're talking about memories and things like that, are we talking about sentimental value? But I'm guessing he's saying monetary value.
I think he's asking monetary value. It's my, everybody talks about numbers matching. No matter what, number matching Corvettes, of course, is the big thing, or number matching Mustangs, etc. Mm-hmm. But when I was doing appraisals, got asked a lot of times, is it numbers matching? And the standard response we were supposed to have is, what numbers do you want to have match? And people didn't know. Granted, when I consigned and sold the 65 Corvette convertible, it was a big block convertible, were numbers matching questions, and we had to, but it still came down to, they wanted the correct rear end in it, the correct engine, correct heads, and maybe alternator or something. It was about all the numbers even they were concerned about for numbers matching. And you can go really deep into a Corvette, a transmission too, but
I was going to say, how far are you going to go? Are you going to go to date codes as well? just that it has the right rear axle doesn't mean that rear axle was built at a time when it would have been in one that was put into that car. So all original parts is there. And that's the problem in the automotive world, I think, is such ambiguous terminology in the collector car world when you get into these valuations. But time, well, it's hard to say. I was going to say, anytime you have a car that's all pretty much all original parts, whether that's numbers matching or at least NOS, all NOS parts used in a restoration, I guess it kind of depends on the car, but you're usually like Corvettes, Mustangs, things like that, Chevelles, the SSs, 396, those cars, you're going to see more value than one that isn't a all original parts and there's repop parts and things like that in it. But then you flip over to the wheel side of the world, where you're building customized cars that have, well, about zero original parts in them, and they're worth more than a completely original car that's untouched. So which way are you going to go?
Excuse me again. I'm sorry. I couldn't get to the cough button. I can show you a lot of cars with all original parts. Unfortunately, they've been sitting in a junkyard for 40 years.
And well, I can show you all original cars that have all original parts in them that never existed.
No, it goes back to condition and really the type of car. I don't know any collectors. I'm sure they exist. I apologize. Collecting Chevettes that are looking for the original alternator, the original transmission, the original motor, the original differential. Derek raises
this weirdo. This weirdo would.
or like me, Dodge Omni 024s. I want another one, but it's got to be matching numbers. Again, I think that's something that's went away over the years, but I also believe the manufacturers have designed that into the cars. I don't quite understand how it works, and maybe you know the answer to this. I know Corvette quit matching numbers from the engines to the Corvette and transmissions and that, because basically warranty replacements and that. Corvette did it. Chevrolet didn't want to have to pay a diminished value if your motor blew up within 1,000 miles in your Corvette Z06, which a lot of them did. But I also thought that there has to be a VIN number attached to every part of the vehicle, the window glass, the door handles, et cetera, so if the car can't be parted out either. So I've never understood how they can take away the identifying factors, but then be required by law to have the identifying factors. Did you know how Corvette did that?
I probably did at one time, and I'm trying to draw it back up. That's been a few years. One of the big things is one of the things I can say that I know about just the manufacturing in general is it's gotten so spread out over the world, global production, and these factories that are all around, they'll have to have their own numbering sequence because you never know what engine is headed for what car. So when the engine's produced, it gets the number from the line. It gets a number at the engine plant, and they don't know what VIN number car that's going in necessarily. So they can't put the VIN on it. It gets an engine number. So it's anymore, it's almost impossible. It was hard back that there's never really been a time that, I'm just trying to think. I don't remember any time when an engine number would match a VIN number, anything like that. There's always a unique engine number, unique VIN number. Those are all usually documented by the factory, right, in the build sheet and that. So you can numbers match with the build sheets. Man, you get back early in the early days of the automobile industry, and it's very, people are like, well, how do that doesn't match? Well, course, and they didn't care back then. Just put an engine in it and put a car with a serial number and get it down the road.
Now, I know there were a few, and I don't know if it was Mopar products or Corvettes or whatever, that had at least a portion of the VIN number that ended up being stamped into the motor at the time of installation or whatever, because you get certain people that, oh, this is the exact motor for this car. After 50 years, I guess the example I'm thinking of is the story about Greg Jackson and his Hemi Cuda, where he found the Hemi motor buried in a field in Italy. And it's the exact numbers matching. There were a lot of Hemis out there. And I don't know how you identify a Hemi Cuda motor unless the portion of the VIN was on that motor. And I still would, if I ever get a chance to interview Craig, I really want to ask him, how did you even find that? Where did you begin? Just, we heard that we were at the local market and some guy was selling eggs, and I happened to mention I had a Hemi Cuda, and he goes, well, I got a Hemi buried in my field in the pig pen. We can get the pigs out, dig that up. If you want it, you can have it.
Oddly, there are stories like that in other worlds, other car worlds. There's a couple Corvettes that has happened with, and it sounds crazy, but if the car is well documented and its history is known, it's not actually that hard. My guess is for some reason that car wound up in that area of Italy at one point, and there was some history with it that said at that point in its life, it got a new engine. And because the couple of Corvettes that I know that this has happened to, their history was documented well enough that, hey, these Corvettes know this history here. We know they went from this person to this person to this person to this person. But along the way, at that third person, there was work done and the engine got changed. So what happened? And then you track these people down, you find out if they're still alive, maybe descendants, friends, start asking questions. And sure enough, what happens in the case of these Corvettes that I know about? Oh, yeah. My buddy or dad, or I can't remember the exact story. He had the old gas station mechanic shop out on Highway 2, and he used to do Corvette stuff all the time. Boom. So we go, start tracking things down there. All of a sudden, somebody's like, oh, you talking about those old Corvettes? Yep. Oh, you know what he did with the blown engines? See that lot over there across the street? That was his too. He'd just go over there, dig a hole, and throw the blown engines in it. Sure enough, go over there with metal detectors, all kinds of metal in the ground. So what they do, they dug up that lot. And what did they find? A whole lot of Corvette engines. And they went through every one and found the VIN number, or the correct engine numbers for the Corvettes, and were able to put them back together. So it sounds crazy, but it happens. And it's as long as the history of the car and can track it and find those moments where something happened, there's a chance you can find the parts.
I'm not saying it can't happen. It just, it's a puzzle.
It's a long shot.
It's a puzzle I'd like to put together myself one day. Is you're kind of going to do the same thing, I'm sure, as we sign off tonight, start looking for your GTO. Here's the VIN number. Google search it. Call your police friends, seeing if they can run it through the DMV.
I still have a few of those back in Michigan.
But now it's just something that I was wondering, and maybe it gets some of you out there thinking of a car that you owned in the past. Would you settle for another one, or do you have to have that exact same one? We all would like, I know we would all like to have the exact same one back, but somebody drops $20,000 in your lap, say enough, somebody drops enough money in your lap that you could go buy that dream car. Would you seek out the one you had, or would you just seek out, say, the best example that you can find for sale today?
Say that again. I think I didn't follow it all the way.
Oh, I was just saying that you want whatever car of your past. I'm kind of talking more just to the listeners to get them thinking. But somebody drops enough money in your lap. The only stipulation is you have to go buy a car that you used to own. Would you take the time and the effort and spend the additional amount of money to find the exact car that you used to have? Or would you just settle for another example? But he drops $15,000 in my lap and I can keep the change, but I have to go buy another 85 CRX SI. Would I take the time to see, and I'm sure it never left the area of the country that I used to live in, would I take the time to see if somebody still owns that car? Or would I just go out and buy the best example that I could find and keep the money and go to McDonald's? Same thing with you is, here's $17,000. Go buy that 93 Beretta. Are you going to take time to see, or are you just going to take the sit? If money was no object, we all would try to find that car that we used to own. But I just wonder how many people would have, how many people would settle for a car that is they used to own and not the exact car they used to own, if you wanted that back.
That's fair. That's fair. I think still, even in that scenario for myself, I think the Beretta would be just a similar one. I don't think I'd hunt the VIN. I don't even know if I could find the VIN, that car. I might have paperwork somewhere. But the GTO, I think, will always be finding the exact one. I think that's just the way that is. That's the way the cookie's going to crumble on that, John.
Like I said, I think it's probably more that, so we have these big massive VIN numbers that are alphanumeric and we can't remember them, but it's really easy to remember that you owned a Mustang 6709 or whatever it was.
Agreed.
Now, is there anything else we wanted to chat about? I know I threw out a second topic, but I think we'll make that a second show.
I was going to say, I felt there was, but I couldn't remember what it was. But if you want to hold off and set it for another show, we can always do that, John.
I think we should set that for another show. But is there anything we need to conclude? I'll touch back on last week's episode where we talked about a woman who perished when she backed her Tesla into a lake, and that it did come out that I think she blew a, or not blew because she wasn't blowing at the time, but her blood alcohol level came back at a 0.23, which is three times the legal limit. But do you think that was a contributing fact to her death? I'm going to say there's still some complications. She should not have been driving, even though she was only on her property. But I don't know if that's necessarily what killed her, since she had had the problems in the past. But I just wanted to acknowledge that. Other than that, you know, I'm not sure too much. I mentioned it to Derek before the show. I might be getting involved with a major, major car club around town, and we might get a lot of content out of that. Not sure. I've had some preliminary phone calls, meeting tomorrow. You got anything else exciting going on in your life car-wise, or we'll just call this a one, cut this one off?
No, I'm just starting to have some fun on causing trouble on Facebook with some of the car groups. But other than that, that's just all I'm doing. Getting in arguments over whether very well-preserved cars that have been found should be restored or not.
That is your idea of fun.
Can you hear me, John? Can you hear me, John?
I can hear you. I said, I guess that's your idea of fun. And now that the technical issues have settled in, I think we'll just go ahead and call it a night so we don't bore you for another 15 minutes.
Am I here?
You're here.
I don't know what's going on. Some tech issue with my mic tonight. So anyway, now just having a little fun on Facebook, getting people riled up over preserving cars, not restoring them, and all that good stuff. So we'll probably have that as a topic on the show some night. See with some of the things John and I have to talk about coming up in the near future. So it'll probably become a hot topic of the show for at least one episode. So beyond that, seeing John wants to wrap it up for the night, I am going to say thank you guys for listening tonight, or whenever you're listening to this. And remember, if you want to help us out, you can go over and buy us a coffee. But other than that, we would really appreciate it if you help us grow and share the show.
And as I say, after you've done that, get off your ass. Go burn some gas. Because John is out.
This show was a part of the No Driving Gloves Network, produced and edited by John Viviani of Magic City Podcast, with voice work by Gary Conger. So until the next exit.